Let me welcome you very much to this lecture, which will be followed by a workshop for the next 2 days. Before I introduce our guest lecturer tonight, let me just say a bit about why we're here and what we're doing. This workshop has been organised by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society in affiliation with the Centre for Sociolegal Studies of the University of Oxford. It's part of a series of programmes. This one is called The Social Contract Revisited. And the idea of the program, basically, is to look at this idea of the social contract as a way of focusing on particular legal and political issues, seeing what it was meant to do classically, but then asking what would it be like to have a social contract at this point in the 21st century. And in this program so far, we've considered issues of welfare, then issues, well, the other side of the coin, I suppose, issues of taxation, who's going to pay for it. And this time, we're looking at questions of employment. Future workshops will deal with minorities and perhaps education and one or two other matters. So it's a continuing program, and I'm very pleased to see you here. Our guest lecturer tonight is certainly well known not only in LSE circles, but remembered in Oxford circles. He spent many years of his early career as a lecturer and tutorial fellow at Brasenose College. In fact, I remember Hugh and I were appointed to these positions at the same time, the same year, so we go back a long way. Since Hugh left Oxford in 1991 to move to a chair at the LSE, a chair of English law, which he still holds. He's also been head of the law department, and he was such a good head the first time round, they invited him back for a second sitting, and so he's currently head of the law department. Well, I won't attempt to go through Hugh's many publications. He has certainly had, on any reckoning, an outstanding academic career in the areas of labour law, contract, commercial law, and also legal theory. I suppose it's worth mentioning, just so we get some profile, his first book was on Marxism and law. That moved through then to later book on employment law, and to one of his perhaps best-known books on regulating contracts. So you can see that Professor Collins has moved around over the years, although probably there's a very constant stream flowing through these various publications. Also worth noting is that he's currently editor of the Modern Law Review, one of the pace-setting law reviews in the country, and I think that that's a position that he holds with considerable pride. And finally, I'd like to just mention his work on social justice in European law, and without knowing a huge amount about this, but I see that this is part of a very ambitious long-term project whereby various academics around Europe collaborate in examining European law in terms of social justice, not social contract, which I have on the brain. So without more about that, let me hand over to Professor Collins to give us our lecture. After the lecture, he will be happy to enter into discussion, answer questions, before we finally decide to go and have a drink. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dennis. It's quite nostalgic coming back here to cold Oxford in the winter. Hope you don't mind my little badge. My commercial law students took objection to it. They all seem to be Republicans. One of my colleagues, whose eyesight is perhaps slightly worse than mine, said to me, "Why are you supporting Osama bin Laden these days?" Anyway, I'm very proud of it, and the downside is, I think, that every time I've got enthusiastic about a presidential candidate in the United States, they've flopped. So, my address this evening concerns the future of labour law. I will not, however, venture a firm prediction about where the law will end up, Rather, I seek to delineate some possibilities, a fork in the road that I see at present, and critically examine the options that stand before us. In the last decade, I will contend, the last 10 years, we've entered into a new phase of labour law, which I'll call, for convenience, the third way in labour law. And having explained what I regard as the new dimensions, the novelty of this labour law agenda, I'll outline what seem to me to be two possible directions for future development of employment law. In particular, I'll examine the attractions and pitfalls of one possible evolutionary route that I'll label, in the German manner, the constitutionalisation of labour law. That's going to test me, I can see. Before engaging with those themes about labour law at this particular moment, let me explain briefly why I think the subject of labour law or employment law, I'll use those terms interchangeably, should be a central concern of the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, the foundation that supports this event. Forgive me if these points seem obvious to you. I can see some people in the front row who'd regard this as mother's milk, but others who haven't devoted their lives to employment law may not quite understand its importance and why people might spend their lives devoted to it. In a market society, employment is the principal source of wealth for most people. It's also one of their principal sources of social relationships and modes of personal fulfillment. The power relationships in the workplace, that's the control exercised by managers over subordinate employees, are one of the main sites of subordination, control, and one of the main sources of inequality in our society. If the search for justice is concerned with the fair distribution of wealth, the capacity for individuals to develop well-being, and the control of power, or any of those elements, therefore, the employment relation should be at the heart of the inquiry into social justice. Employment law provides the legal framework, the institutional arrangements, and the state's contribution to guiding and controlling the operation of employment relations. In other words, employment law establishes the standards of justice that affect nearly everyone in important ways. So I think it is central to your inquiry about social justice. To establish a central proposition of my talk that the third way represents a new conception of justice in labour law, it's necessary to reflect on the character of what it replaced. I'm going to describe those prior arrangements for justice in labour law as industrial pluralism. I'll use that phrase to describe what went before. And I'm going to suggest that there was a social contract. The industrial pluralist model was a kind of social contract. Not in the philosopher's model of everybody sitting around agreeing behind a veil of ignorance. On the contrary, this was everybody knowing exactly what they were doing in a very fierce and conflictual atmosphere, but this was the deal, in my view. The central ideas and principles of the scheme of justice of industrial pluralism are, I think, reasonably familiar, even if the term is not. At the heart of the employment relation, industrial pluralism identifies an inherent conflict of interest between employers and workers, or between capital and labour. The conflict concerned not only the distribution of the profits of the enterprise between the suppliers of capital and the suppliers of labour, but also the working conditions and the power relations through which the productive organisation achieved those profits. To avoid that conflict, that inevitable conflict, escalating into damaging disruptions to productive organisations or even a revolutionary catastrophe, industrial pluralism proposes institutions and principles through which a fairly stable and equitable balance of power could be established between capital and labour. This theory applies not only to the workplace, but more generally to politics. The labour interest, as well as capitalists, need to have effective representation both in the workplace and in government and parliament. In the workplace, the institutions and principles designed to achieve this industrial pluralist scheme centred on collective bargaining. To represent workers effectively, it was necessary to permit them to organise themselves collectively in unions, and for those unions to engage in collective bargaining with employers for the purpose of setting agreed terms and conditions of employment. And in order to ensure that workers had effective bargaining power, it was essential that they should have access to the threat to withdraw the supply of labour collectively, industrial conflict, since that threat was their main source of bargaining power. At the beginning of the 20th century, Parliament in this country created a legal framework that endorsed and protected this industrial pluralist scheme of justice. We can describe this legislation as amounting, in my view, to a social contract between capital and labour. This legal framework, comprising principally the Trade Disputes Act of 1906 and the Trade Union Act of 1913, provided what came to be regarded as more than just a temporary political accommodation between capital and labour, but rather as a kind of constitutional settlement or social contract between capital and labour. Similar legal frameworks followed shortly afterwards in other advanced industrial countries, under the Weimar Republic in Germany and as part of the New Deal in the United States. Despite their differences of style and detail, at the core of all these legislative schemes was the recognition of the legitimate role of unions to represent workers through collective bargaining. In Britain, there was a further element to this legislative scheme of industrial pluralism. It was widely recognised that certain industrial sectors, known colloquially as the sweated trades, where it was unlikely that effective collective bargaining would develop rapidly, if at all. To extend the institutions and benefits of industrial pluralism to those sectors, a number of devices were employed. One possibility adopted widely in Europe was the extension of the results of collective bargaining agreed by some employers to all employers in the same industrial sector. Another possibility was the creation of what in this country was eventually called wages councils, which mimicked the processes of collective bargaining with the assistance of third parties for the purpose of fixing minimum rates of pay in an industrial sector. The general ambition of this legislative scheme, though never completely realised in practice, was to fix the terms and conditions of all workers through free collective bargaining or similar institutions. If one considers these legal arrangements as a kind of social contract, the deal in its essentials had the following terms. In return for the trade unions and workers' political parties recognising the legitimacy of private ownership of the means of production, employers would concede to unions both a say in the management of the enterprise and the right to bargain as a cartel on behalf of their members for better wages and conditions. Crucially, the outcome of that collective bargaining would be regarded as a just settlement by all sides. As a result of bargaining between capital and labour from positions of roughly equal bargaining strength, a collective agreement would produce, it was thought, a fair distribution of wealth and power. I'm not suggesting, of course, that everyone was happy about the arrangements and outcomes. Both sides, capital and labour, regularly complained about unequal bargaining power in general and the unfairness of certain agreements in particular. Even so, though industrial pluralism could not promise perfect justice, it was accepted, albeit reluctantly, as the only realistic option as a standard for social justice in an industrial society. In comparison with other advanced industrial societies, the legal framework for employment relations in Britain was what might be described as labour law light. The statutes were brief, and for the most part, the courts stayed out of industrial relations. Laws on minimum wages and maximum hours were, for instance, noticeably absent. As an emigre to Britain from the collapsing Weimar Republic, Otto Kahn-Freund marvelled in the 1950s how much the industrial relations system in Britain was self-regulating outside the law. Famously, he described the system as collective laissez-faire, to stress the absence of legal regulation. With the benefit of hindsight, I've criticized his assessment for underestimating the importance of the legal framework that constituted the industrial pluralist settlement, and my colleague Keith Ewing at King's in London has similarly insisted on the crucial importance of the legislation to sustain the broad coverage of collective bargaining beyond traditional industrial sectors. But even so, Kamfroin was undoubtedly correct to observe that, unlike in most other industrialized countries, legislation in Britain was sparse and few labour disputes ended up in the courts, or in modern terminology, there were low levels of juridification of industrial relations. Although I've told this story in my own way, necessarily simplified for this short presentation, I don't think there's much disagreement among scholars about the general historical picture of industrial pluralism in this country. The interpretation of what happened in the 1970s and afterwards in Britain is undoubtedly more controversial. My own version of events, which I'm going to try to sell to you, is that in its essentials, the industrial pluralist vision remained present, constant, and dominant. Although the law was changed at frequent intervals, and indeed new legislation followed every general election, the framework of industrial pluralism in its essentials remained unchallenged, I will argue, till the new Labour government came in 1997. So let me try to justify that claim, which I think will be regarded as controversial. The legislation of the 1970s and 1980s, such as the Industrial Relations Act of 1971, the Employment Protection Act of 1975, and the Trade Union Act of 1984, certainly changed the legal framework. Instead of labour law light, Parliament now sought to enact a complex, detailed framework for regulating collective bargaining and industrial relations and industrial conflict. All political parties attempted this task because it was accepted that the almost miraculous system of self-regulation that Otto Kahn-Freund had so much admired had broken down. So collective laissez-faire was certainly abandoned, and in its place were enacted rival schemes for detailed regulation of trade unions, collective bargaining, and industrial action. Different diagnoses of the causes of the breakdown were offered. Popular at the time, as laid out in the report of a royal commission we called the Donovan Commission, was the view that Britain required new plant-level, factory-level institutions of industrial relations to secure peaceful, consensual outcomes. Now, there was certainly a problem there, but I think that Paul Davis and Mark Friedland are correct to stress there's an even more important, incipient tension existing between, on the one hand, a policy of collective laissez-faire, labour law light, and on the other, the growing ambitions of the state to manage the macroeconomy to secure growth without inflation and to provide the benefits of a welfare state. My point, though, is that no one was seriously proposing a different solution to the question of justice from the principles of industrial pluralism. Instead, the political parties were attempting either to diminish or to increase the power of organized labor or capital according to their political preferences and allegiances. But they weren't attempting to abolish collective bargaining as the appropriate method for determining terms and conditions of working people, as the appropriate method for establishing a just society. It might be objected, I think it probably will be, that the Thatcher governments enacted so many measures designed to weaken the power of trade unions that in effect they were seeking to abolish collective bargaining altogether, get rid of trade unions, and replace it all with individually negotiated contracts between employer and an individual employee. Such a policy, if fairly attributed to the Thatcher government, would indeed represent the demise of industrial pluralism. Such a policy would promote the justice achieved by individual negotiation of contracts of employment without either collective bargaining or substantial legal regulation. In a sense, such a free market policy would represent a new social contract to replace industrial pluralism. It would be a social contract that declared that no more social contracts would be made. Perhaps, just as it was asserted famously by Mrs. Thatcher that there was no such thing as society, so too there could be, given there was no society, there could be no such thing as social justice. But is it accurate to suggest that the Thatcher governments were aiming to alter radically the social contract of industrial pluralism in this way? Although I'm sure that free market individual bargaining view might be fairly attributed to some members of those governments in the 1980s and early 1990s, in my view, the legislation itself, though restricting the power of trade unions, was not in the end very dissimilar from, for instance, the industrial pluralist model in many countries, such as the United States. It was an industrial pluralist model, in other words, that wasn't very favourable to trade unions, but it was still pluralist, just. In arguing to the contrary and suggesting that a more radical agenda to dismantle industrial pluralism prevailed, my teachers, Paul Davis and Mark Friedland, can certainly point to government statements under the Thatcher and major governments that emphasised the desirability for individual workers to be able to negotiate their own terms and conditions of employment. But such statements favour the introduction of greater flexibility into labour markets, but they're not necessarily proposing the abolition of collective bargaining or life-threatening restrictions on collective bargaining. It's also true that the Thatcher government systematically removed all those legal provisions that sought to extend collective bargaining to unrepresented workers, or that imposed minimum terms and conditions through wages councils. And to that extent, they abandoned the strong version of industrial pluralism that had prevailed since 1946. Again, in my view, that left a legislative framework with certainly a lower commitment to the promotion of the institutions of industrial pluralism, much as it had been, in fact, in the 1930s, without, however, altering the basic framework. The real break, in my view, the real change with the industrial pluralist model, the industrial pluralist political settlement or social contract of the early 20th century came, I suggest, with the Blair government, though there were elements of it in the latter days of the major government, of course. By the close of the century, changes in the economy, such as the decline in manufacturing industry and the associated rapid decline in union membership, appeared to render the old political settlement of industrial pluralism irrelevant to the majority of the working population. Whilst not dismissing the old social contract entirely, the Blair government offered a new deal, which I suggest comprised three main elements. First, the government promised measures to ensure social inclusion. The key goal in this policy was to try to enable all adults to enter the workforce, have paid work. Implementing measures included the raising of educational standards, thereby enhancing employability, making social welfare payments conditional on searching for work, imposing minimum wages and in-work benefits to eliminate poverty traps, promoting flexible working arrangements, especially for parents, and outlawing a wide range of forms of discrimination. Full employment was the ambition and the primary solution to questions about the distribution of wealth and social justice in this model. Second, the government promoted partnership in the workplace. Although collective bargaining could be regarded as a form of partnership, the government rather emphasised that there should be dialogue in the workplace about working conditions generally, not necessarily about wages or pay at all, and that the purpose of the dialogue should be to improve both competitiveness and a sense of fairness in the workplace. Third, a dominant aim of all labour law legislation became one of enhancing the competitiveness of business. Every initiative had to be justified on the ground that whatever other objectives it might have, it had to satisfy the test that it would improve competitiveness or profitability. For example, anti-discrimination laws, the new laws we have about age discrimination and all these other laws, were justified both by arguments about social inclusion, as you'd expect, but also by an insistence that businesses would become more competitive if they tapped into all the talent available in the working population, regardless of skin colour, sex, ethnicity, religious belief, age, etc. In my view, this third way agenda was radically different from the early 20th century political settlement in three respects. I've gone over the description of the third way because I've written about that extensively, but so I'll just summarise those three points. What I'm going to do here is try to explain why I think this is very different from industrial pluralism and what came before. First, I think it was much less interested, the third way model, in the distribution of wealth in society. The collective bargaining model of industrial pluralism supported an endeavour to raise the living standards of the whole working class by enabling them to obtain a greater share of the profits of private enterprise. The purpose of promoting collective bargaining was to achieve redistribution towards the workers at every level, from the highly skilled to the casual manual workers. There was not such an egalitarian agenda in the labour law of the third way. It's true that it was expected that by enabling everyone to obtain work and by fixing a minimum wage, the government would eliminate the worst aspects of poverty. But the main distributive agenda was identified as eliminating child poverty and pockets of low pay, not to increase wages more broadly across the whole of Middle England. Secondly, there was an acceptance in the third way agenda that individual bargaining in the context of competitive market forces would be the primary determinant of pay and conditions. Like the prior Thatcher and major governments, there was no open declaration of the end of industrial pluralism. Indeed, there was a modest, very modest attempt to reverse some of the most egregious restrictions on trade unions and to provide a weak legal mechanism to support collective bargaining. But there was no sustained attempt to restore the institutions of industrial pluralism. Wages were not regarded as normally a matter for group or collective determination, but essentially a matter of individual choice and effort, performance-related pay. Institutions for collective discussions were important, but for the purpose of dialogue and sharing of knowledge, not for redistributing wealth through collective negotiations over pay. This aspect of the third way agenda could, no doubt, easily be mistaken for support for a simple free market in labour. But it differs because of my third point, which is that the third way agenda had no hesitation in direct legal regulation of working conditions where that was believed necessary to support policy goals. Instead of leaving matters to be negotiated through collective bargaining under the old approach of collective laissez-faire or industrial pluralism, or left to completely unregulated market, as perhaps Mrs. Thatcher wanted, the government intervened to influence in detail the terms and conditions of employment. As well as the minimum wage, for instance, there were minimum hours laws and rights to flexible working arrangements. In other words, the regulatory state took on the job of regulating the labour market. Much of this regulation, it should be stressed, was not in the crude form of command and control. It adopted instead more subtle techniques of promoting processes and trying to be reflexive in the sense of permitting agreed variations at a local level. For instance, larger businesses were not simply told that they were required to have a works council for the purpose of dialogue with certain specified institutional configurations for the purpose of consulting their employees. There wasn't just a model that they all had to comply with. Instead, the Information and Consultation of Employees Regulations of 2004 set up a structure whereby employers are given every incentive to establish their own version of a works council, because if they do, they will not have to comply with the statutory framework at all. Such a negotiated agreement leaves the employer maximum flexibility, because all the employer has to do is reach an agreement that has to specify who will represent the workforce in these discussions, and it can be, and including the possibility of the employer appointing the worker representatives, and the circumstances in which the employer will inform and consult those representatives. That's all the employer has to do. Given this regulatory approach, I'm not convinced it's helpful to view such measures through the lens of hard or light regulation, or that of deregulation or re-regulation, as Mark Friedland and Paul Davis try to do in at the end of their latest book on the history of labour law, trying to figure out whether it's hard and soft regulation. It's true that the regulatory strategies differed according to subject matter, no doubt about that. But I think a great deal of that variation can be explained by calculations about what laws were likely to be effective. One finds, for instance, increasingly hard mandatory regulation in the sphere of occupational pensions, as earlier, more flexible measures were perceived as failing to achieve their purpose. They ratchet up the regulation because the earlier regulation doesn't work. On the other hand, the examples of the right to request flexible working hours and the right to request not to retire demonstrate a low level of regulation in which the employer can resist such requests fairly easily by following a certain procedure. Despite this low-key intervention, the government clearly expects that these measures will change what happens in the workplace. They clearly expect that the right to ask for flexible hours will change the attitude of employers so that it will become normal. And so too the right to ask stay on after retirement might also have that effect. Though as far as I can tell, the government seems to be right about the right to ask for flexible working hours. That does seem to have helped change the culture. But I think nothing much has happened about retirement yet. People are still expected to go at 65. In the picture I've painted of this third way agenda, in the foreground lies the regulatory state. The task of government is to regulate the labour market and productive organisations in such a way as to promote competitiveness and social inclusion. Success in the pursuit of such goals should both improve the total wealth of society and also distribute it by high levels of labour market participation. Yet, it seems to me that this scheme for employment law, this third way scheme, lacks much semblance of a social contract, a scheme of social justice. It seems to me to be aimed at technocratic control based upon expertise rather than on a broadly accepted social consensus about justice and fairness in society. Its legitimacy depends upon periodic parliamentary elections rather than on an ongoing process of dialogue and negotiation as under industrial pluralism. Furthermore, increasingly the operations of this technocratic government are determined at the supranational level of the European Union. Given that the labour market is likely to become more transnational following the open up of consumer markets, capital markets and so forth, it certainly makes sense to aim for transnational employment law. Yet this move tends to reduce the political accountability of the technocratic regulators, producing the fear that the European Union might take a more deregulatory path that removes the protections of working people. So far, that fear has been proven unfounded. But changes in the political complexion of other countries, France, Germany and Italy, could cause a change of the political agenda about employment law in Europe, which the UK, whether it liked it or not, could not stop. In this picture I've been painting, the regulatory state is in the foreground, but it's harnessed to a much larger beast of the European Union that restricts its movements and increasingly determines its objectives. The former social contract of industrial pluralism provides a misty backdrop at the back of this picture that fades into the horizon. And to pursue this metaphor further than may be wise, on either side of the regulatory state stand heroic figures, both claiming to represent the ordinary working people, but urging the regulatory state to move in very different directions. One heroic response to this situation of a transnational regulatory state is a call for a reinstatement of industrial pluralism. It's argued that working people should not put all their faith in the competence of the regulators, particularly remote ones in Brussels, to achieve improvements in the standards of living and an effective say about their working conditions. On the contrary, only working class organisations, particularly trade unions, can be trusted to pursue the aim of securing greater equality in society and fair regulation of the workplace. Accordingly, whilst preserving some of the regulatory state apparatus, such as the minimum wage and unfair dismissal law, on this view, this hero argues that the law should reinstate the goal of promoting the institutions of collective bargaining and permit organised trade unions to improve the welfare of their members. The opposing hero calls for certain legal safeguards about the operation of the regulatory state. Here the idea is to enact constitutional safeguards that constrain the rules and operations of the regulatory state. These safeguards would be constitutional in the sense that they would state general principles or rights, would be entrenched in some manner, so they couldn't be swept away by changes in political fashion, and they would be legally enforceable in the courts. Such constitutional safeguards could be enacted at both national and European level. On this view, the law would prevent regulators from intervening in labour markets in ways that unjustifiably interfered with basic rights. The task would involve the rebalancing of the economic constitution of Europe, so that as well as protecting the fundamental market freedoms, the treaties would also guarantee basic social and economic rights. This is the root of constitutionalising labour law. So for me, there are these two siren calls, the calls to revert to industrial pluralist model and the constitutionalising ideas, social and economic rights. To some extent, these two views aren't incompatible. It's possible to include in a statement of these constitutional rights a framework for the institutions of industrial pluralism, the right to be a member of a trade union and so forth. But I think there is a fundamental difference in philosophy that will eventually push these two responses in different directions. In my perception of this movement towards constitutionalisation of labour law, this movement accepts fully the third way agenda of using the regulatory state to steer the economy, the labour market and organisations. The constitutional aspect merely adds to this agenda by placing legal constraints on the regulations. In contrast, the industrial pluralist agenda resists the inroads of the regulatory state, preferring instead to trust the institutions of collective bargaining. There's a preference for self-regulation through collective bargaining rather than state-imposed regulation. Furthermore, the philosophy of the constitutionalisation of labour law seems to be directed at securing basic rights for everyone, whereas the social contract of industrial pluralism was more ambitious in the sense that it wanted to go further to improve the standards as far as possible, well beyond the minimum for most workers. And of course, from the point of view of an employment lawyer, the central difference is that advocates of the constitutionalisation of labour law clearly envisage a major role for the law and legal institutions, such as courts, in securing social justice. And in contrast, advocates of the return to legal pluralism prefer rather less regulation and more autonomy for collective bargaining. It has to be said that New Labour has firmly resisted the siren calls from both sides. These heroes have been ignored. There's been no enthusiasm for reinstating laws that would strengthen the institutions of industrial pluralism. Equally, there's been stubborn resistance to any suggestion of conferring legal force to social and economic rights. I was shocked, I think, fairly recently, when the UK government returned from negotiations about the Lisbon Treaty, declaring a great victory that they'd managed to keep out social and economic rights from the Lisbon Treaty. However, I do think that the momentum for constitutionalisation of labour law is growing, and it may prove unstoppable. At the European level, there are many calls for rebalancing the economic constitution. Rebalancing the economic constitution in the sense of balancing the fundamental freedoms of the European Treaty, the free market freedoms, with a set of social and economic rights, which would in some way re-establish a kind of social contract for the peoples of Europe. And we see the problem in cases that have been coming before the European Court of Justice, such as the recent Viking and Laval cases, where the court is confronted with an issue about the legitimacy of industrial conflict or trade union activities and organisation. And this action looks almost certainly contrary to the fundamental market freedoms of employers. And the European Court of Justice has nothing to turn to in the treaties to find a way to balance and control these attempts by employers to dismantle the labour laws of their national regimes. Similarly, at an international level, I see increasing numbers of calls for the provision of more effective means of enforcing social and economic rights. For instance, there's at present a call for the United Nations General Assembly to adopt an optional protocol on the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That declaration includes social and economic rights, that would provide a mechanism for the United Nations to supervise the practice of nation states with respect to social, economic, and cultural rights in the same way that member nations are supervised by the Human Rights Committee with regard to civil and political rights. So there's quite a lot of steam, I think, behind this idea of constitutionalising social and economic rights, constitutionalising labour law. It's even got into Parliament and the Joint Committee on Human Rights in Parliament has written a report recommending that this should be considered. In Britain, the standard criticism of making social and economic rights justiciable is that such a development will reduce the power of democratic institutions. And there have been many responses to that, including recently by Sandy Fredman in her book on Human Rights Transformed. But I think there's another issue lurking beneath the surface which hasn't been adequately addressed as well. So constitutionalisation of labour law seems to make the rules less democratic because the judges will control it. But I think there's another problem as well, which is the potential conflict between, on the one hand, the goal of regulating labour markets and businesses in order to promote competitiveness, the central goal of the third way, and on the other, the goal of guaranteeing basic social and economic rights. Consider, for instance, the law of unfair dismissal. The right to be protected against unjust dismissal is usually included in covenants and charters of social and economic rights. The policy of regulating employment for competitiveness also, in fact, endorses the law of unfair dismissal for reasons I won't go into. But the competitiveness agenda is likely to place limits on the scope and application of the right to claim unfair dismissal. For instance, its application may be removed from temporary and casual workers, as in the UK, or it may be removed from small businesses, as in Germany. If the right against unjust dismissal was recognised as a legally enforceable, constitutional, fundamental right, there's clearly a risk that such restrictions would be invalidated. No doubt the issue would eventually become one of proportionality. The question for the court would be whether the restrictions on the right to claim unfair dismissal served a legitimate purpose, were necessary to achieve that purpose, and were appropriate. This question would be a difficult one for a court to assess, and the legislature might find that its carefully considered policy about competitiveness was upset by the judges. So my contention is there's a considerable tension between the goal of regulating labour markets for competitiveness and the potential force of justiciable fundamental social and economic rights in the labour sphere, a tension that I don't think has been adequately addressed and thought through. A brief conclusion. Despite these justifiable concerns regarding the effectiveness of democratic institutions and the risks to the policy of regulating employment for competitiveness, the need to restore a social contract in the labour law field seems to me to demand a substantial move in the direction of constitutionalising labour law, both at the level of the European Union and the level of the nation state. The regulatory state needs to have limits placed on its operations, not only with respect to civil and political rights, but also with respect to social and economic rights. Thank you very much.